Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 165 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, Tristan? What's up, everybody? 165, who we got today?
Cal Fussman, man, the storyteller.
Yeah, man, that's the art of storytelling. This guy, years and years of experience, and 1 hour isn't going to be able to do what we want to do with Cal. You know, this is a guy you sit down and chat with for like days.
Yeah, it's one of those different podcasts. Today, we're going to move a little bit away from health and fitness, but the stories this guy will bring, I don't think you want to miss it, because we get stories like Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, like his own story about, you know, transitioning into the stage. Like, there's some great stories here that he shares.
For sure. I mean, he's worked with, you know, huge, huge figures over the last four decades. You know, he started out, you know, a boxing columnist, and the world's starting to get to know him through the Ferris podcast. And that's kind of like an awesome thing about this modality of information podcasting. You get to, you know, a guy like Cal, who's probably in the 60s. Maybe early 60s.
Maybe 50s.
You know,
he looks young.
Yeah, he's fresh. His spirit and his energy definitely is young and fresh.
Look at that hat that you like.
Yeah, he reminds me of like Lawrence Krauss. Lawrence had that hat.
Yeah, a little bit.
Paul Simon. Do you know Simon and Garfunkel? I think it's a New York thing.
Maybe.
I think it's like a...
Is Krauss Jewish?
I think so, actually. Krauss. I bet you it's cultural. That style.
Yeah, because Cal's
it had to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and they're all kind of shorter. And yeah, I'm stoked to hear his rendition. If you guys Google or go to YouTube, you'll see Cal telling a bunch of different stories. But he's one of these, he could tell the same story over and over, but it still has conviction. He uses voices and emotion. Yeah, it's an awesome one. It is a little bit different from health and wellness, but in a way, expression is wellness.
Yeah. Let me read out, because this is one of a bit different, because Cal likes to talk. So what happened was that... he wanted to talk about Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather. So we kind of used so much time speaking about the fight for the first 10 minutes that I didn't even get to introduce him in. So I'll introduce him now, just so you can get a bit of background if you haven't heard about him before. So Cal Fussman is a New York Times bestselling author. He's a writer at large for Esquire magazine. He's a keynote speaker and interviewing consultant. Now, his extensive career, he's got this brilliant work that he does. He calls it the What I Learned section, and he gets the best quotes from all the awesome interviews he does. So it's not just when he does an interview, his interviews can sometimes take 7 days. Like, he's going to tell us a story about how he stayed with Muhammad Ali for 7 days, but he's also interviewed the likes of Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Ted Kennedy, Jack Welch, Serena Williams, Richard Branson, Mikhail Gorbachev. You know, the list goes on.
It's everybody. And global on. Leaders he's interviewed.
Yeah, and on. So check out his work before or while you're actually listening to the podcast, www.calfussman.com. His Instagram is Cal Fussman. Twitter is probably where he's the most active. It is Cal Fussman. So Fussman is spelled Fussman.
There you go. Get after it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get Cal on straight away. And here's Cal Fussman.
Let's do it.
I have a feeling, you know, I was listening to Chris Algieri, and I didn't know if you wanted to talk about Conor McGregor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big boxing guy.
We know that's how, where I grew up in a town called Youngstown, Ohio, a big boxing town. And, you know, I first heard of you years back reading. I read a couple things that you had written on the boxing scene.
Oh, yeah, because back in the 80s, I wrote a lot of boxing. And then even later in the 90s. So Youngstown, isn't that Ray Mancini's hometown?
Yep. Yeah, so we've had Ray on the show. I grew up with Kelly Pavlik, who was a middleweight champion of the world. We actually played in the Little League World Series together in 1994.
Oh, man, how'd you do?
Yeah, we lost lost out in Williamsport to California, but Kelly was my catcher. I pitched. Good friend of mine.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, man.
So I don't, You tell me what you want to talk about. I'm game for anything.
Ah, that's awesome.
I think we're going to be telling stories about everything, getting a little bit of advice from me and Johnny. And
yeah, Tristan boxes. We both – yeah, boxing's a big thing. So that we're stoked. And, you know, the storytelling side of things. Let's just see where this thing opens up to.
Well, hold it. Did you see the Horn-Pacquiao fight?
Oh, yeah.
What did you think?
I thought, well, I'm Australian, and I thought Pacquiao won by two.
I thought Horn won the fight, and it's just that here's my opinion on why the people think, like the ones who think Pac won, is that that ninth round, everybody saw Manny at his best. Like, we saw Manny in his prime for that one round, and I think that his prime was just so far between what Horn's best would look like, and I think people judged it on that.
That's pretty interesting. The rematch will probably be very interesting. It's going to be in Vegas, is that it?
Possibly. It's because later in the year it gets too hot in Australia, so for them to do it outside again, it'll be nearly impossible. So, yeah, I think you're right. Probably be in Vegas.
Well, that should be pretty interesting. I think it'll probably be a close fight. I remember, you know, what happened with Pacquiao and Bradley the second time. He handled Bradley much, much easier. But you know what? With these guys, they get a certain age, and their bodies just change.
Absolutely. Yeah,
nothing they can do about it.
Hey, can I tell you something that no one's actually brought up? I think what really took Manny off was fighting outside.
That's a very good point.
Like fighting outside compared to inside in an arena with sun coming in your eyes and just having the elements, all the Aussies yelling for Horn, I think it's big.
Yeah, I probably took some, I don't know if it took a toll. I'm sure it was wind at Horn's back, you know, to have the crowd behind him like that. And look, he fought gallantly. I'm not going to take anything away from him. I thought that it was a pretty close fight. I thought Manny won. But I think it's good that they're going to have a rematch, and we'll figure it out from here. But to my point, like, if you can remember years ago, the fighter Roy Jones Jr., yeah. He was light heavyweight. I mean, people could barely touch him.
That left hook.
That's right. He was so quick.
That check hook, yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't loved get it. Near him, and then he'd hit you. You had no idea coming. And then all of a sudden, he went up and he won the heavyweight title by beating John Ruiz, who is not really a great heavyweight champion. But still, to go from 175 pounds all the way up to heavyweight, it's a major accomplishment. And he probably should have, like, retired at that point.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to get any better. Either that or maybe he could have fought Mike Tyson. Which would have been a scary proposition for anybody, but he took more time, and then all of a sudden, he just, you lose a little bit of reflexes, and you're cooked in boxing. The punch that just missed by an eighth of an inch, all of a sudden it hits, and people go down.
So, I agree.
This is something that Manny may have been up against in terms of his reflexes, because you're right, he was not the Manny of years past.
Yeah.
And, you know, Horn was a bigger fighter.
Much bigger fighter.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of interesting as we look forward to the Mayweather-McGregor fight to see if Floyd has lost any of that quickness and if Conor can somehow figure an unusual angle out to get in a good shot, and what might happen. It's kind of absurd that a guy who's never had a boxing match is fighting the greatest fighter of a generation. But as you can tell, it's got everybody talking. What do you guys think is going to happen?
Well, see, and I'm into both sports. I've been watching the MMA since '97, since Hoyce Gracie fought Ken Shamrock. But, you know, I grew up in Youngstown, so I'm a boxing purist. And up until, I think the media and the UFC side of things, guys like Joe Rogan, Brendan Schaub,
they're kind of doing a really, really good job on brainwashing the public into forgetting how great Floyd is.
I agree.
And people, dude, did you see the odds, Cal? The odds here are like 325 now. It's crazy.
Well, you know what's a big reason for that is the gloves went from 10 ounces to 8 ounces. And so, like, the gloves were an interesting part of this because McGregor usually fights with 4-ounce gloves, which it's basically just barely covering your fists.
Yeah.
And up till 147 in boxing, you're fighting with 8-ounce gloves in Las Vegas.
Mm.
When you hit 154, it goes up to 10 ounces. And so when you think about that, like, that's more than double the padding that McGregor would have on his hands. It's going to be hard enough for him to hit Floyd to begin with. And so I think a lot of people thought, well, you know, he's got very little chance. There's some people are saying that McGregor won't even be able to land a punch. But then they took the glove size down to 8 ounces because both McGregor and Floyd requested it. Floyd, probably for reasons of pride, because I don't think he wants, if he wins, he doesn't want to hear any excuses.
Well, yeah. And then also, like, when is the last time Floyd has accommodated an opponent? Like, he's done it twice now. He's done it with the 8-ounce gloves. And then also, like, in his past fights, Floyd's always been, he wouldn't budge on negotiating before, like, you know, the stipulations of the fight. And now it's, there was another thing that he agreed on with Connor that it was kind of shocking to me that he would allow that. But do you think
what was the other, do you remember the other
thing? Yeah, it was the gloves and the, was it the money or the contract dispute? It was something with the contracts on how his opponents normally sign and what they sign to with the media restrictions. And with Connor, he allowed Connor to have his way, sort of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Mayweather is a genius in two respects. One, defensively in the ring.
Mm.
And when we look at this guy, we're looking at him at 147 pounds, older, brittle hands, doesn't have much of a punch. But if you have been around for a while and you can remember Floyd walking around when he was a 130-pound champ.
Mm, knocking people out.
Yeah, he was putting people away. And at that weight, he had a superior height advantage. He had a pretty devastating punch to go along with all of his skills. And this time, we're seeing something far, far different scenario. And I always thought the one welterweight, it's 147 pounds, that Floyd would have had a great deal of trouble with.
Amir Khan.
Was Tommy Hearns.
Oh, yeah. I think he would have a lot of trouble with Amir Khan now.
You think Khan?
Yeah, because Khan wouldn't have a threat of a one-punch knockout, and that's his biggest...
But Khan's soft, though. A guy like...
He's so much faster than Floyd.
Yeah, but a guy like Hearn, we're talking, though, like,
yeah,
danger.
He's, yeah, dangerous.
Like an exciting definitely. Fight.
And he's big, too. What is he, 6 foot one?
No, like 6'2", maybe 6'3", with an incredibly long arm reach that Floyd would have had to come in past to land the punch.
Yeah. Did you ever watch him live, Cal?
Did you see the Hearns? Were you at the Hearns Hagler?
I was sitting ringside for Hearns Leonard.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
That was when Ray...
I guess that ages me a little bit, but it was... It was amazing, and in that fight, that's what Leonard had to do. Leonard was a smaller guy, and he ultimately, with his eye barely open, I didn't even know how much he could see out of one of his eyes. He basically, in the 12th, 13th round, had to like walk through Hearns' right hand, and I never really have seen Floyd coming in at an opponent at this weight. At 130 pounds, he could do that, but this is going to be 147, plus McGregor can come in at 154, and if he's rehydrating.
He's going to be huge. 170, 175.
170. How big was Oscar? How big was De La Hoya when they fought? Oscar looked way bigger.
And Oscar was 100. They were both 147, I believe.
No, 154. Yeah. They fought at junior middleweight.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I watched it yesterday.
Oscar, he looked huge.
I got to check that, man. That was at 154?
Yeah, it was at 154 because they wore 10 ounce. And that's where Mayweather took his first crown at that weight.
Wow. Okay. That's,
Oscar clipped him, too.
Surprising.
Yeah, he caught some good punches, especially early.
Yeah, Cal, you were on record. I heard you were talking about the electricity in the garden during the Frazier Ali days, and how the keeping it on boxing. How you were saying like guys like Foreman, Frazier Ali. You know, it's changed because they'll never be fighters or even personas like that again. What's your opinion on the current state of boxing, and is that still hold true?
Well, it's kind of interesting because you now have two really good heavyweights, certainly in England, United Kingdom. Everybody knows about Anthony Joshua. Not as many people in the United States know about Deontay Wilder, but both these guys are undefeated. You know, both of these guys, I think Deontay Wilder is like 6'8 or 6'9. Joshua must be 6'6", 6'7". You know, these guys are coming in at like 240, 250 pounds, which is much different than, you know, Muhammad Ali coming in at like 215, 218, and then much lighter when he was earlier in his career. And that's an interesting fight. But what's the difference is, back in the day, there were social ramifications to all these fights because Ali was bigger than boxing. He was basically standing up for civil rights. And unfortunately, Joe Frazier got pulled into it and was sort of taken under the wing of the white people who were rooting against Ali. And so everybody who watched that fight was watching something bigger than a boxing match. And as a boxing match, it was unbelievable. But when you threw the whole tone of America into it, and the fact that they were both heavyweight champions at the same time, both undefeated, the reason that that could happen was because when Ali was drafted into the military in the middle of the 60s, he refused to go. He said he was a conscious objector. And, basically said, I ain't got nothing against no Viet Cong, right in the heart of the Vietnam War. At that point, his title was stripped away from him, and he took his case to the Supreme Court. And for 3.5 years, he wasn't allowed to fight, during which time Joe Frazier came along and was knocking everybody out with his left hook. And so on March the 8th, 71, when the two got in the ring, you had two undefeated heavyweight champions for the first time. But it was so much bigger than that because Ali was so much bigger than that. Now, I don't know, like outside maybe of England, where Joshua's got a big following, if you're just gonna have that fervor. It's more of a sporting event where it was just something beyond that back then. It was something that everybody certainly in America was needed to know about in the moment. And I know it's going to be interesting because, well, you know, wherever I go, people are talking about Mayweather and McGregor. I mean, it doesn't have any of the social ramifications, but you know, there's a lot of juice around this fight.
Mm. Hey, Cal, preparing for someone like Muhammad Ali, the first time you interviewed him, what was the process like there, man?
Interesting, because he had been my childhood hero.
Yeah.
And so I knew just about everything about him. from the time I was a kid. And I watched all of his fights and was constantly following him on the news. Back then, there was no internet, so you got it from like World of Sports, or it was always something that when it came out, it was a must see. So I felt that I had a pretty good idea who he was. The interesting thing about it to me is it's very intriguing to meet your hero, because a lot of people are disappointed with that experience.
Mm.
They go to meet their hero and they put their hero up on such a pedestal. And then they meet the hero and the hero is just a human being and can't live up to it. And there's an interesting story. I don't know if this happened, but I heard about it. And so I like to tell it anyway, because it kind of makes the point. But the movie director, Martin Scorsese, his hero was Akira Kurosawa, the Japanese director, the guy who directed the movie Seven Samurai. It's an all-time classic. And so one time Scorsese's going into a party, and one of his friends runs up to him and says, "Hey, Marty, Kurosawa's inside." And Scorsese just turned around because he didn't want to be disappointed. And that story told, the amazing thing about the week that I spent with Ali is that after the week was over, he was more heroic to me than he was before I met him, because of the way he treated me and the humanity that I saw in him. And that was what was most beautiful about the experience.
Cal, when we finally got this booked in, and you know, once again, Tris and I are both really stoked to have you here, sharing the space with us. But we interview like world champion fighters, Fortune 500 CEOs, writers, people who have like, you know, seen what the top looks like, and then give advice to our listeners. Let's stick to storytelling. I thought I was a good storyteller until I started getting into you and researching your work. Specifically, I want to talk about the story that you're telling about Ali at his house. You bring up Bundini, you bring up the well, you know, and I wanted to ask you if this is like advice, or is it just come natural? In that little short 3 or 4 minute story about boxing with Ali, and you saw him dancing and you're hitting the bag like Frazier, you use so many different emotions, almost as like an exclamation point to guide the story. Is that something that comes easy, or is that something that's planned when you're telling these stories?
I think part of it is natural, in that when you tell stories, you realize that all stories start with vulnerability. If you do not have a vulnerable character, you really have no story, because that character needs a vulnerability in order to get through obstacles and get to a finish line of sorts. So the interesting thing about that story that you referenced with Muhammad Ali and I is that we were both vulnerable in some ways. Ali had Parkinson's at the time. I got the call to interview him in 2003. So this is more than 20 years after his last fight. The world knew that he had Parkinson's disease by then. We'd all last seen him on a world stage in Atlanta, Georgia, in the 1996 Olympics. I don't know if you can recall that image where the Olympic torch comes up to him as a complete surprise, and he goes to light. It's like a little rocket that's going to climb a cable up scaffolding where the Olympic cauldron lies. And then this rocket that's lit will ultimately ignite the cauldron. And few people realize when Ali had the torch in his hand and he leaned down to light that little rocket, that somehow the rocket had been like overdrenched with flammables. And it was sort of like in the old days, you used to have trouble sometimes if you flooded a car engine by getting too much gas in it, you couldn't start your car. Well, what we were seeing was Ali with that torch in his trembling right hand, and he was putting it down to light that little rocket, and he couldn't seem to get it in the right place. And we all thought, oh my God, what if he can't do it? Here's this guy who won an Olympic medal, one of the greatest athletes of all time, and what if he can't light the torch? It's like the whole world was holding its breath. And none of us knew that it was not Ali's shaking hand that was stopping the torch with a little rocket from getting lit. It was actually the problem with the flammables on the rocket. And so Ali is keeping this torch down there to try and get it lit. And the flames are actually coming in on his arm. And it really makes you understand what I loved about him. When you realize that he's shaking right hand is basically trying to get that little rocket lit. And through no fault of his own, it's not lighting, but he just kept it there, even though the flames were coming in on him. And then finally, ultimately, the rocket got lit. It climbed to the cauldron. The gigantic flame erupted, and so did everybody's heart. And so when I went to see him, the image that everybody had was of the guy with the shaking right hand at the top of that Olympic stage. And that had been like almost 7 years earlier. So the question was, how's he doing now? And that's when I went in to see him. And what happens, and here's where the vulnerability comes in, I go to meet him, and I hold out my hand to shake his hand. And he knows that he's my childhood hero. So he comes in, and he just wraps me in his arms in a big embrace. And then he slowly, on soft, timid steps, slumps into a cushy leather chair, and I take a seat on the sofa. And I'm there to ask him about all the wisdom he's accrued in his life. And he doesn't like seem to be particularly paying attention to my questions. He seems preoccupied with his right arm. And his right arm is like shaking from the elbow down to the fingertips. And now both of his arms are shaking. And I'm thinking, should I call his wife? I don't know. The next thing you know, his breathing is starting to be labored. And not only are his hands shaking, his legs are shaking. And his breaths are coming in gasps. And that's where I just said, Champ, Champ, are you okay? And slowly his head starts rising. And it looks me in the eye. And as we're at eye level, he says to me, scared you, huh? And so we got two senses of vulnerability going there from the start. One, he's physically vulnerable. We know that. But two, I'm going in looking for wisdom, and I can't really figure this out. And so what you have moving through the rest of the story is me trying to move forward to figure out what's going on and ultimately pushing Ali to a point where we both find out how much his body can give. So what would happen is, the day after I first met him, we go out, we have a great meal. Then he has to travel a great distance. And because of that, he actually needed a wheelchair. the following day, we didn't have to go a great distance. And so he didn't take a wheelchair, and we're walking out of a restaurant, and some people see him on a hill over where the restaurant was, and they start running for him. More people see those people, and they join, and it's almost like there's a stampede, an avalanche coming down on us. And he's got to get to a car that's maybe 40 or 50 feet away. I guess that's, what, 15, 20 meters in Australia. And he's got to get there quick, and he does. He moves quick. The day after that, guests come over to the house, and he's doing magic tricks for them. Can barely speak above a whisper, but he's doing magic tricks. Day after that, he takes the medication for his Parkinson's disease, turns his tongue orange, and as we're conversing on the couch, he just falls asleep right in the middle of the conversation. And I'm just looking at him with his leg jangling into mine, thinking, how am I going to possibly explain this in a magazine story? I just don't have the questions. I don't have, there's no questions that are going to solve this mystery. No questions that I can think of asking. And I only got a day left. So now there's vulnerability. You see me in a vulnerable state because, and you see him in a vulnerable state. Basically, he's taking this medication and he's asleep on the couch. And I am very nervous that I'm going to have this week and not know what to write. So what happens is following day, I'm down on my last day. We go to breakfast, and Muhammad's wife says, "Champ, you never exercise anymore. Why don't you go down to the gym with Cal? Work out a little." Muhammad rolls his eyes. "Oh, all right, Cal, come on, let's go." And we go over to the gym, only it's not like a gym. It's more like a museum. It's a boxing ring in the center. Looks like nobody's ever stepped foot in it. Exercise equipment all around. Looks like it's right out of the box. There's no smell of sweat. There are mirrors around all four walls. And above these mirrors are huge photos, iconic photos of Ali's great fights, principally with his arch nemesis, Smokin' Joe Frazier. So I'm walking around looking at these photos, and this is the three fights between Ali and Frazier. That was like the thrill of my childhood. I knew everything about these guys, down to the childhood stories that defined their styles in the ring. So, for instance, Ali, when he was a kid, he would ask his younger brother Rudy to go out in the street with him, pick up rocks, and throw it at his head. And Ali would stand out there in the middle of the street as a rock was coming straight at his head. And just at the last minute, just before it hit, he'd just lean back and let the rock whiz by. And that was his style in the ring. Dance like no heavyweight had ever danced before. You couldn't get close to him. And if you did, threw a punch, he'd just lean back, you missed. And then he hits you like 20 times faster than a shoeshine guy could buff a pair of shoes. Now, Joe Frazier, on the other hand, very, very different story. Joe was born on a farm in Beaufort, South Carolina, short, stocky guy, doing chores. Joe's dad had lost the left arm. And so Joe's dad would be cutting lumber with a cross saw with the right arm, and Joe would be on the other side of that cross saw with the left. Back and forth, every month, every week, every day, until over years, the muscles in Joe Frazier's left arm evolved into a brutal and devastating left hook. That was the one punch that a kid who could avoid rocks in the street was vulnerable to, because it came from out of nowhere and you couldn't see it coming. So watching these guys fight was like watching lightning versus thunder, only Lightning had gotten a little older, and that was because of what I just told you earlier, how Ali had lost 3.5 years after he refused to enter the military when he was drafted. So he comes back, and he's older, and he's not as fast as he used to be. And he's never been in the ring with anybody as relentless and devastating as Joe Frazier. And he starts to get hit. And he starts to get hurt. And when he does, he's got this corner man named Drew Bodini Brown who exhorts him on, just screaming, "The world needs you, champ. Go to the well once more. Go to the well once more." And always, Ali would reach deep inside himself and find what it is he needed to rise to the occasion. So I'm walking around, and I'm looking at these photos, and I'm hearing Bandini in my head, "Go to the well once more." And I realize that's my question. What is still in the well? And so now, you've got two characters who are still vulnerable because I still have to figure out how am I going to get to a place where I can write this story so that everybody can understand it. And Ali is vulnerable because we don't know what is still in the well. And so what happens is I'm looking around and I see a rack filled with boxing gloves and I start thinking, should I take the risk? Should I try? And I walk over and I take 4 gloves off the rack. I put 2 on his hands and 2 on mine. So now you, when you're listening to this story, you don't know what's going to happen. Plus, if you are seeing me, you're saying, oh, this guy is like 5'6" and 150 pounds. He's got 2 boxing gloves, and he's looking at Muhammad Ali, who is a big dude. But he's also got Parkinson's disease, and we just don't know what's going to happen. And so at that point, I always stop the story there to explain another story that gives an indication of what's about to happen. And that other story goes back 10 years earlier when, in order to write another magazine story, I trained for 7 months to get in the ring with Julio Cesar Chavez when he was the junior welterweight champion of the world. And that was when he was 87-0 with 75 knockouts.
You're crazy.
And I did get in the ring with him. And I'm still here to talk about it.
How did that end? How'd that fight end?
That's going to be another podcast. So what happens is in the 7 months prior to that time, I just wanted to get in the ring with Julio for 1 round. It actually went longer than that. But in the 7 months that I trained for that fight, I trained in the exact style of Smoking Joe Frazier. And so I got these gloves on. And I get down to crouch just like Joe, and I start bobbing and weaving back and forth, only I don't come at Ali. There's a big heavy bag, and I just move into that heavy bag, and I just start throwing that left hook, and believe me, I could even sound like Joe Frazier. So I'm pounding on that bag, and I'm looking over at Ali to see how he's taking this, and his eyebrows arch like a sleeping lion awakened by an old familiar scent. "You're good," he said. And he waves me out of the way. And then he goes at the heavy bag. He's throwing really fast punches. I said, "You think that's going to keep me off?" I go back to the bag. He goes back to the bag. I go back to the bag. He goes back to the bag. Finally, I just throw everything I own into this bag. And Ali looks over at me. And that's the moment that I knew. I knew that he knew what my question was. what is still in the well? And he just, with his left hand, holds it up and he slowly waves me off to the corner of the gym. I walk over to the corner of the gym, and that's when I saw something I never thought I would ever see again. Muhammad Ali started to dance. And he's dancing around the bag, moving around. And not like when he was 21, but he still had the rhythm. He still had the grace. And he's dancing. And as he's dancing, he's looking at himself in the mirror. And as he's looking at himself in these mirrors that are all around the room, his chest starts to rise. And his head starts to rise. And he's dancing. And he's dancing. And then he stops, pivots, and he threw like 50 shots faster than my eyes could even catch him. I was just stunned. My jaw was down to my knees. And then he turned away from the bag, and his left foot went over his right, and he stumbled. And I'm saying, oh, no, no. And now he's falling. No, please, please don't. No, please, please. Oh, no. No! Goes down on these mats next to the heavy bag. I'm like paralyzed. Don't know what to do. Don't know if I can do anything, even if I knew what to do. But I break through it, and I run over to give him a hand up. Before I can touch him, he's already turned on his back. And he's doing sit-ups. And then he's doing stomach crunches. And then he's bicycling his legs in the air. Then he gets up. He goes over to the super leg press. It's got hundreds of pounds on it. Grips the handles. Working it back and forth. I said, Champ, you don't need to do any. You don't need to do any more. That's a lot of weight. Feels good, he said. I thought I had pushed him as far as I possibly could. We've seen him move past his vulnerability. And now we've also seen that I am on a path to getting what I need for the story. And he waves me back to the house. We go toward the kitchen, and he asks me to sit down at a table outside. And he leaves. And he comes back with a sheet of paper. And he puts it down right in front of me. And this paper is filled with wisdom, with quotations. And he points to a quotation in the middle. It says, God will not place a burden on a man's shoulders, knowing that he cannot carry him. And I'm just staring at this line. I think, oh, my God. And he walks off into the kitchen. Comes back out a few minutes later. His left hand, he's got two bowls, two spoons, and his right, quart of ice cream. The two of us sit at the kitchen table, and we eat ice cream together. And nothing is going to be a better moment that you're going to have with your hero than sitting down and having some ice cream with him.
That's a great story, man.
That trumps everything that Tris and I will ever be able to even experience.
I don't think so, because I love what you guys are doing, man.
Yeah.
I think you guys are just getting started.
That's a very inspirational story.
Hey, Cal, that brilliant way of you expressing and telling stories. You know, before when you used to do a lot more writing, now you're standing on the stage in front of all the corporations and things like that. Was it easy to go from a good storyteller writing into a good storyteller actually presenting on stage?
That is a great question. You know, what happened was I only started speaking about a little more than a year ago.
Mm, wow.
What happened is I was asked to speak on a cruise ship filled with entrepreneurs. And since I had never done anything like it, we took the time to go back through a lot of these interviews that I'd done with Ali and Robert De Niro and and Donald Trump and
Jesus.
Larry King. And so I basically wrote out this speech, but I still had no experience in front of crowds. And I'm figuring, you know, there's a lot of speakers on this ship. There's 4,000 entrepreneurs, and the speakers are going on all day long. There's probably 15 speakers speaking at the same time I am. Maybe 17 people are going to show up. And I get a weekend in the Caribbean, and, you know, I love hot tubs. So I said, all right, I'll do this. And I go to do it. And what I didn't realize is the person who marketed this was very smart, because he marketed it as decoding the art of the interview with Mikhail Gorbachev, Robert De Niro, Donald Trump. And so, like, you felt like they were showing up to give the speech. At least that's what may be one of the reasons why everybody started coming through the doors. And so I arrived, and basically every seat's taken. There's like billionaires and CEOs sitting cross-legged in the aisles, people standing room only into the back wall. And there's a long line, like at a nightclub, to get in, and people can't even get in. And that's when I had to get up for the first time and speak. And you're like, oh, man. Gee. But I had practiced, so I was able to go up and do it. And then when I did, everybody stood and started cheering. And after that, people started asking me to speak at their events. And it's just been like a continual cycle of every time I speak, somebody hears me and then asks me to come to their event. And over the last year, I actually tried to get on stage as much as I could so that I could perfect it, because what you realize is every stage is kind of different. There's different lighting. People are paying attention in different ways. So I just wanted to take this time to make the stage my home. And right now I'm starting to feel, yeah, whenever I get on stage, I'm at home. I've spoken in front of 3,000 people. I've spoken in front of 16 people. It doesn't matter anymore. I'm comfortable. So it does take time. You got to put in the effort. And if anybody was starting to speak, I really would recommend you just do it as much as possible. In fact, I was at a Tony Robbins conference, and he pointed out that when he started, he realized that if he wanted to do this as his life's work, that he wanted to compress the time that it took to get really good at it. And so he started speaking like 3 times a day in the beginning. And now you see him speaking for 12 hours straight, and you understand where it came from. It was all the practice that he put in. So that's basically what I've been doing for the last year. I haven't gotten to Australia. I got as far as South Africa. But one of these days, man, one of these days, we're going to be drinking some good Australian wine.
Oh, that's yeah. Right. For sure. You'll come down to Sydney. Tris and I will show you around. We'll wrap the hands, and you'll show us that I want to see that left hook you perfected from studying Fraser. But, hey, Cal, you have this awesome – one of the quotes I have written down, you know, I never learned anything while I was talking. And it reminds me of – Tris and I, we experienced this moment together about a year ago. We were getting ready to interview – do you know Hoyce Gracie?
Oh, yeah. I've never met him, but
yeah, of course I know. You know of him. So it was one of these moments that Tris and I, we put ourselves in this vulnerable scenario. We pretty much probably weren't ready to interview him in a sense of experience. We meet him in an octagon, and in those moments of just watching him, how he walked, his English was a little broken. I learned, you know, it reminds me of this quote that you wrote. I want to ask you about, could you share maybe a similar story that you have with the wide array of elite people you've spoken to, maybe something like that?
And And so what exactly are you looking for?
Like maybe something like you going into an interview with somebody, you know, for instance, Hoist was one of the most dangerous people on the planet. And the things I learned from him was reverence and respect, how he carried himself. He had this regalness about him. I wasn't prepared. I didn't expect to learn that from him, especially because it wasn't anything that he told me. It was me watching his movements, like mannerisms. Was there anything like, you know, Larry King, you know, Trump, all the guys that you've interviewed, do you have any like kind of insight on like a cool lesson you learned from them without them saying anything to you?
Well, one of the interesting things about Larry King is I came out to Los Angeles to write or help him write his autobiography. And we started to do our research and conversations after breakfast every morning. And he basically sat down at that point, it was 9 years ago, with a lot of his childhood buddies. They were all in their late 70s, mid 70s, late 70s. And then I sort of joined the table and became a regular. I've had breakfast with him every time we're in Los Angeles, every day for like the last 8 or 9 years. And in the time that I was with him researching the book, he would bring me to a CNN show and I would be sitting like a few feet away from him. It was off camera. He could never see me. But what was happening was I was listening to him speak. And my form of asking questions. In fact, after the first time I interviewed him, I said, is there anything I can be doing better? And he said, stay yourself. There's no trick to being yourself. Stay authentic, because if you try and do what I do, if you try and do what Oprah Winfrey does, what Charlie Rose does, Barbara Walters, classic American interviewers, you're not realizing that it works for them because they're them. What works for you is you. And so it's not that I learned to ask questions from Larry, but I really wasn't a speaker. And after his show ended, he did a comedy tour, went around America. And I just listened to him tell his stories. And it was almost like having an internship where you're just taking what he does with speech in through osmosis. And so when I did get up on that cruise ship to speak, it's almost like everything that I took in over years, like sort of like having a 7 or 8 year internship. And then all of a sudden you're called up on stage to perform, and you can do it because you've been in the gym all these years and you were watching, you were paying attention. You really do know how to do it because you've seen one of the greatest of all time do it. So when you get to that point of royalty or being regal, I mean, I look at listening to Larry King telling stories as, well, that's why they call him the king. So I got that sense from him. I always had that sense from him. And then over time, I was like slowly be able to incorporate it into my speaking pattern. So he had a much greater influence on me as a speaker than he did as an interviewer. And it's why I'm now going around the world giving talks. Because if I hadn't met him, I don't think that would have happened.
So it's...
Hey, Cal, that technique that you use, the aim for the heart, then the head, and the clear path to the soul. Where were you when you figured that out, or did someone teach that to you?
You know, where I was when I had to write that speech, it forced me to go back over the interviews that I had done. And, I was kind of like, if you can imagine like an old grandma who cooks a really great dish that the family loves. And the family goes to her and says, "Grandma, what's the recipe?" And grandma says, you know, you take a little salt, you throw it in there. I never really gives it a recipe. Probably because grandma knows that if everybody else has a recipe, they won't go running to grandma. But I basically had developed these recipes without ever really writing them down or understanding how they work. And when I had to do that speech, it forced me to understand, like, how do I do what I do? And that's when I realized the heart, the head, and the soul was my approach. You ask, always ask your first question. Always aim your first question for the heart. Then follow to the head. And then follow the heart and the head and a pathway to the soul.
That's awesome. Are you, Cal, do you remember the Jimmy Valvano speech at the 93 ESPYs?
I do. It's amazing.
Oh, every time I'm kind of, time I need like a shock, he says the three things. Yeah. The laugh, the think, and the cry, those emotions. When I was researching you and developing my questions to talk to you, for some reason, I kept going back to his speech. And that's what it reminded me of in the way you tell your stories with those certain emotions. Do you have any advice or insights on how to take writing about emotions into speaking about the emotions in terms of like getting your point across? I know you mentioned vulnerability being a really important factor there, but I feel sometimes when I write, because I write a lot too, and then it's tough to translate into speaking about it. And it seems like a secret.
Well, you know what? You find that a lot of people can speak really well and can't write. And a lot of people can write really well and can't speak.
Yeah.
Now, you got to work at it in order to make it go both ways. I would have to really boil it down for you. And here's the crazy thing. Kevin, the manager who booked this engagement, booked it like for an hour. So I got something in 3 minutes.
Okay.
And I am going to ask you if we can rejoin this conversation at another point, because I feel like we're only halfway through, maybe a 30.
Yeah, man.
Absolutely.
I love you guys.
That sounds great.
So you can figure a way to have me back and we can talk about Penfolds and some great Australian wine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Marlboro region. Some Sauv Blancs.
Oh, there we go.
There he is.
Riesling.
Yes.
On your West Coast, man.
Yeah. So we'll contact Kevin and then book that in then part two, man.
Okay. That's great because you guys are wonderful. I so enjoyed talking to you. I feel like we could have done this at a pub. And we should.
Sounds great. So, I think that's the next step.
For sure.
Let's do one in Australia. I got to figure out a way to find a booking agent over there that can get me over to Australia, and then we'll go straight to the pub first.
Sounds like a dream, man.
All right.
All right.
Well, before we let you go, Cal, we'll have all the details on the show notes, your website, www.calfussman.com. I know you're very active on your Twitter, Cal Fussman, Facebook, C. Fussman, and Instagram, Cal Fussman as well.
All right. Thanks a lot, Cal. Thanks for sharing the space.
All right. We're going to pick it up again.
Yes, sir.
Johnny, Cal Fussman, bro.
Yeah, man. He was definitely right. We should be sitting in like a public square at a bar with him telling these stories.
Well, he wanted to. Yeah. He thought he deserved that coming back to Australia.
Yeah, hopefully we need to get him down here in Sydney.
Do something. I think people deserve to hear these stories.
For sure. I'd like to see him in like an intimate setting, like one of the small, like imagine him at like the opera house.
He reminds me of someone that would just sit there like in those little leather black chairs with cognac or something in his
head. Yeah, right? Like a monocle. But even, I'm just really, I love storytelling and I'm really fascinated with people really great at it. And the things, and I can't wait to have to re-listen to this one because the voices when he's telling the story about Muhammad Ali and his facial expressions changing like a sleeping lion, like a sleeping lion. And you could just see his, when he heard Fussman hit the bag like Frazier.
So not easy. Like,
I love
his,
that.
His way he's describing is like, that's not easy. Like, to be able to experience something, like people are going to experience something and not be able to take away sometimes something from it.
Yeah.
He's able to, because you can't tape record someone's expression too. You've got to know it, right?
Yeah, man. Just, Bandini Brown, the people need you, champ. Go to the well. Dude, I could see in that sweaty gym, fat, you know, rewind to the 1950s and 60s. I don't even know what Bandini Brown looks like, but the way he tells that story, I have a vision of what he would look like in my head. And I think that's a sign of a great storyteller. Like, he didn't, being able to paint pictures with his words. Like, the guy, yeah, he could have spoke over.
Well, yeah, it looks like there might have to be a part two and part three. Now, I understand why Tim had to take him on two or three times, and their conversations were long too.
Yeah.
I had a feeling this was going to happen, the fact that we're not going to get through enough that we had to in an hour.
Did he start – I don't want to plug anyone else's podcast, but did he start his own with his
– Yeah, using Tim's –
But on Tim's
– Yeah, it was last week with Larry King.
Okay.
Because Tim wanted Larry King interviewed for his podcast, so he said he's very good friends with Cal, so I think he put him up – to, because Cal was still, I think, 50-50 whether he wanted to start his own podcast.
Yeah.
So Tim goes, well, here's a platform. I want Larry interviewed. It makes sense. Have a crack.
But so Tim wanted Larry interviewed just to be next to the Tim Ferriss brand and didn't want to interview himself?
Yeah, I think so. I think he wanted to give Cal an opportunity. I think they're very good friends. So, you know, well, I guess Tim's podcast is downloaded like a million times, so it's probably a good way for Cal to get his name out there a little bit more, and that's a perfect way to start a podcast, right? Using an existing fan base that probably already know a little bit about your work, and someone like Larry King, what an amazing first guest.
Yeah, for sure. Did you, is it out? Is it aired?
Yeah, it's out.
Did you listen?
Yeah, I did.
Is he good?
It's very good.
Awesome. Yeah, Cal, man, he's, like I said,
Larry's like his big brother.
Is that the banter between?
Yeah. He puts shit on him like a lot.
How old's Larry?
It's like, Larry can't be older than my dad. My dad's 70 this year. Larry would have to be in his mid-70s.
Larry was in his 90s. How old is he?
He's been around for a while.
Yeah, man. He's interviewed it. His interview style. Yeah, his style is one of my – I got to hear that. Cal Fussman interviewing Larry King.
Well,
wow.
Cal's writing his book.
Cal is writing – a book
Larry, Larry's autobiography.
Oh, wow.
So they meet up every morning for breakfast.
That's
and then
awesome.
They sit down and do their, I think, an hour or 30 minutes of writing.
Yeah.
And I think that's their little thing.
Cal's energy, he seems like he's like a 20, like a 15-year-old.
Yes.
Is that, he has a young, he has a youthful energy.
Absolutely. You can just sit right, like, he's the sort of bloke that just, you just want to sit down with and just, you can just let him speak.
Like, we didn't even get to open up the story about, you know, his expose with Julio Cesar Chavez.
I know, he talked about it a little bit.
Yeah, but we didn't, like, we didn't get to open that up.
1933.
Yeah.
He's 83 years old.
Yeah, Larry's 113 years old.
83. And he's still going to work.
Yeah, he's a beast. He's on a constant mission to learn. I mean, open up in a sense, like, I wanted to, what made you want, like, was it serious? Was it 50-50? He said he was doing it for...
I think it was serious on his part.
87
and trained for 7 months.
7 months, right? But, Jesus. He didn't talk about it. All he said is he's here to talk about it. Does that happen behind closed doors?
I think because he was writing an article for his magazine on Chavez. So I think it was one of those things that...
Talk about professionalism.
To experience it.
You know what I mean? Like, that's all you really have to know about Fussman's work ethic. That's like method actors. You know, going in like a guy like Daniel Day-Lewis.
Christian Bale.
Yeah, Christian Bale, who just, they have a project and they're going to become the project. Like, cheers to Fussman, man. I wonder if he's a beast.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take a beating. I mean, like, that's like you and I preparing for Whittaker, and we're like, you know what? Let's just fight to do this.
Oh, Rob's 30 kilos heavier than me. I wouldn't do that. I'd do my Conor McGregor, though.
You know what I'm saying? What'd you just say?
I said I'd do Conor McGregor.
Are you calling Conor out?
I'd call Conor out.
You think you could take him?
Yes.
Are you serious? I love it. You really believe you can take Paulie?
This is going to come out after the fight, too. Yeah, so I might be embarrassed. He might have just knocked out Floyd.
Yeah, you really think you, like, in real life, on real shit.
I got more boxing experience than Conor McGregor.
No, I'm saying on real shit, you think you would take Paulie, though?
Oh, yeah.
I love it. You really think you'd be able to fight, you would beat up Malignaggi?
He couldn't handle my speed.
Oh, I love it. You hear that, guys? We got to somehow set that up. I like to
say that. Paulie's pretty cool.
I like Paulie. But he's, you should try to do expo, like a you know, product on, or not study humming, trying to create that. Look, man, I want to do a piece on you.
I want to fight you. That's actually very smart. That's a very smart idea, Jonathan.
We should start doing that.
Like, all right. So this is part of the interview. We're going to fight.
We have to fight.
And I'm going to go 100%. You're going to go 20. And you have to let me knock you out.
Yeah, man. We can definitely take this rest of this podcast and talk about that fight. But we don't want to bore everybody.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Before we end the show, next week we've got Erin McKenzie on. Erin, she's a two-time Olympic gold medalist. We had her husband on, Brian, a couple of weeks ago. He was absolutely fantastic. They'll be in Sydney at the end of September as well. So make sure you check out their website for all the details on their seminar. It's going to be like a breathing seminar, which is quite cool.
Yeah, the Art of Breathing, September 30th. Was Erin going under the name, was it Erin McKenzie or Cafaro when she was competing?
Cafaro.
Okay.
Cafaro, if you want to check her out.
Yeah, Americans, two-time Olympian.
Yeah, in the row. Rowers, the eight.
I believe one of the gold medals was the first ever for the women in that event. I have to double check.
She was part of a team that went 10 years undefeated, and she was part of it for 6 years.
So they just had the squad.
The women's eight, you know, the one where they sit in the big boat with eight girls.
Yeah.
So
they just had like the dream team.
Pretty much.
6 years. That's crazy.
That's a long time. Apparently I've written down in one of my notes for her interview, but there was one of the nations, I think it might have been Ukraine or something, or Romania, and they kind of dominated and they stopped their reign. Let me see if I can just kind of flick my notes quickly.
Yeah, it's another one of these power couples.
Interesting sort of topics. And she's very undersized for us. She's only 175 centimeters tall, which is very short for a rower.
How tall is that in feet?
That would be 5 foot.
7 or 8?
8-ish. I think 5'7" is 170, so it's probably 8.5.
You said rowers are big?
I think rowers are very big. I'll have to ask her about that. I think they're all 6 foot plus.
Okay. That's another thing. The Australian culture is really tuned in with the like Olympic events.
Oh, absolutely.
You guys, like you were talking earlier off air about trampolinists.
Yeah.
Like being an Olympic. Coming where I come from, it's like Olympics. Oh, basketball, boxing.
Yeah.
What other sports are
there? Swimming, athletics probably be the main ones, but there's all these little ones that you get that, you know, they have to give up so much time. Judo, taekwondo, you know, a lot of these guys don't get paid. They just get subsidies.
Did they take wrestling out of the Olympics?
I think so. I think that's not good.
That's a shame.
Not when you're adding shit like rugby sevens and fucking.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure ping pong is in the Olympics.
I'm assuming wrestling has been there since the Greek ages, right?
Dude, it's the foundation and backbone of every mixed martial artist. I mean, it's. Not every, but MMA now, where it's evolved, wrestling is a huge part of that. To be dominant, you need that. You're not going to be a champ without that background.
It's funny. I went to Greece and I went to Athens, and they've got the Acropolis, and I think that was where the first Olympics was or something. And apparently, like the first Olympics, they're all naked and shit.
I hope so. Yeah. Have you ever seen Turkish oil wrestling? This is real rap, guys. Go to Google right now. YouTube. Type in Turkish oil wrestling.
And what happened with Turkish
oil? So Turkish oil wrestling, the boys wear like leotards and they're like, you know, it looks athletic. Like the tights, right? And they get oiled up. And your goal is, once you lock up, is to either put your hand up your opponent's bum or you grab the penis.
Okay.
I'm dead serious. Dude, I'm dead serious. I saw this on a podcast. I thought they were lying. I Googled it. Go, and it's part of their culture.
Oh, wow.
Turkish oil wrestling.
Good for them. I have to ask Darren about that.
Yeah, DK was saying.
Wow.
Wow, we digress.
Perspective. Have to message him in a minute.
It'll explain a lot.
Yeah.
The boys.
All right, Jonathan, before we go, social media.
Guys, follow me, Johnny Stofko, on all across all of them, man. How about you?
Tristan Cannell. Hit us up.
Simple.
info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. Please send through any feedback, or you know, if you want to have a chat with either myself or Johnny or both of us, yeah, send an email.
Hit us up, guys. Share it with your friends. We appreciate you.
Yeah, for the people that are waiting for Dom D'Agostino, we actually had a slight delay today, but it will be done in the next 2 weeks. So stay tuned. We just got to get everyone's schedule on point, but I'm sure we can do that quite simply.
# keto, ketogenic, ketosis, and we're going to ask, please explain and break down what the H. What's the simplest way to explain ketosis?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we're going to do for you guys.
Absolutely. So stay tuned for some great episodes ahead. And please tell your family and friends.
Yeah, buddy.
All right. We'll check you next week.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast. Stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, and that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.